you know, in the early 60s, Spicer and Robert Duncan were making inroads into Vancouver, and then Robin Blazer moved here.
Yeah.
Warren Tolman and his wife, Ellen, were catalysts in part for that. Is that how Vancouver got on your radar?
Yes. When I finally decided to leave San Francisco in 1971, there was only one place I could be considered going was Vancouver, because that's where I knew people. Blazer, Persky, Tallmans.
Well, Spicer and Duncan were coming up here to give lectures.
In 63, yeah.
And the conference in 63. So
right, yes.
Yeah. Were you here for, you were not here for the conference.
No.
No, yeah. You know, we've mentioned a couple of times now the serial poem. That was your, I mean, hanging around with Spicer and Blazer, certainly, that's probably where you would have heard about it.
Yes.
Can you talk about first hearing the concept and sort of your feeling? Do you remember at the time of what it meant?
Well, it meant you've probably got a definition of it somewhere. I've got one written down by Blazer. It's a poem which the individual parts of it do not have a definite completion, but the poem completes itself in the entire run. And there isn't really any logical or necessarily or narrative connection between the parts. The parts can be quite disparate. You know, one of my serial poems written in 1967 was called You, and the parts have hardly anything to do with one another. But it does have the sense at the end of having been a poem.
Oh. When you're writing like this, the content declares itself underhand, as Olson was saying. Maybe you're not consciously seeing the links, but someone who can read it more objectively looks and says, oh, here's a thread, or here's a thread, and people are outside of it.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it's an easy habit to get into, because instead of writing a perfect poem, you just write something, and then the next day you write, or the next week you write something else, and oh, here's something, these things seem to move like a serial poem, and then you're into one.
You talk a little bit in the interview in the Capilano Review about how you were writing a certain way, and you were writing Vancouver poem that way, writing quickly, but not, you can't do it that way anymore.
Well, I don't know. That's how I felt when I did that interview. I don't know whether I can do that again. I mean, I may have to revert back to that method again. That's the method called free writing. I remember the name, but the academic is Peter Elbow, who wrote a book about it. But the process is probably better known through the works of Linda Barry, who's a very popular writer. You know Linda Barry?
Is she a cartoonist?
Yeah.
Yes, I do know.
And she has written books, you know, books for things for kids to do and all that. And one of them, she just lays out exactly what you should do. Write. Keep writing. Do not think. Don't take your pencil off the paper. If you get stuck, just write stuck until you start thinking again, until you start writing again.
And that might come out of Natalie Goldberg, too, the not put the pencil down kind of ethos.
Yeah. So that is the method that by which a lot of this book was written, Vancouver book.
Writing carelessly.
Yeah, right.
Certainly, in the academy, if you start talking, you went there to talk to the students and said, no, you need to write carelessly. You know, it's like,
yes.
I can imagine that would exclude you from a lot of future invitations.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you can see that the opposite of careless is uptight. So, I mean, if you're not careless, you will miss. I'm not quite sure how I'm saying that. Daniel Bouchard has a very good essay in that Capilano Review about, I think he calls it Careless in Vancouver, playing on the film title.
Sleepless in Seattle, right. Another Cascadia city, so
yeah.
Which has a lot in common. I mean, I'm driving here, and I'm seeing the traffic circle with the lavender in it, and I could be in Seattle when I see stuff like that.
But another aspect of what you were saying is the connection between San Francisco and Vancouver. There is no connection, as far as I know, between Vancouver and Seattle. In fact, Scott Watson wrote an art essay. He said, Vancouver and Seattle are the two cities in the world, artistic centers, that have had the least to do with each other in all history of art.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I think that when I think of Seattle, I think of Tess Gallagher, and I've forgotten the name.
Retke.
Retke, yeah.
Carolyn Kaiser.
Yeah.
Sam Hamill.
And who's the great Seattle poet who died in Montana?
Richard Hugo.
Richard Hugo, yes. And then to conclude, Portland, William Stafford. All of those poets relate somehow to, I'm not sure whether it would be the Midwest of the U.S., to Iowa and Minnesota. It's a completely different connection, and it's more in the academic world.
I'll probably take Sam Hamill out of the list that we just mentioned He's translated, and he's translated Basho and Chinese poetry, and certainly has a Pacific Rim ethos. But the other ones, if you were to categorize them, which is always dangerous, we go back to that division of the New American poetry.
Yes, exactly.
Right. So they're not New American poets. It seems to somehow have skipped Seattle for maybe a generation or two.
Yeah. Yeah, the New American poetry of Allen's, the same year, I think, was the book called The New Poets of England and America, edited by Donald Hall, and I'm not sure there's a British editor as well, but those two anthologies sort of established the split in American poetry, which exists to the present day. Now, in Canada, I don't think there's that much of a split. There's a different kind of split in Canada. In other words, I don't think there's that much of a split between followers of the New American poetry and followers of American academic poetry, because there aren't any followers of that American academic poetry. So the New American, the Canadian poets of the Tisch group, probably, and similar group in Toronto, and I'm not sure of the origins of that, probably are the dominant poetic community in Canada.
Doesn't that say a lot for Canada?
Well, it does, but then in Canada you have the other split, which is regional. Canadian poetry is extremely regional. I was talking to David Farwell, who was Ruffin Blazer's partner. We got on this subject, and I was surprised that David agreed with me. He said that I've never become a Canadian poet, and David says that's probably pretty true of Robin too. Both Robin and I remain American poets who have become part of the BC poetry community, but that's where it stops.
Yeah, I'm just fascinated by these things that you bring up, the split between, George Bowring never had a reading in Seattle until I got him one 6 years ago at the subtext reading. And it's stunning to me how ignorant Americans are of poetry that's 2.5 hours away from them. And not just that. I mean, the Tisch is a pretty legendary, when you look at the history of world poetry, Tisch, I think, is going to be pretty legendary.
Of course, yeah.
And that split, and the notion here in Canada that people like George Bowring and Fred Waugh become parliamentary poet laureates, whereas in the United States we have people who are from the more academic poetry, one poet laureate before it was even called a poet laureate was William Carlos Williams, and he was blacklisted right out of it during the McCarthy era. So that's how they treat open form poets,
right?
New American poetry poets,
right.
Talking with George Stanley in his apartment in Vancouver, I'm Paul Nelson. Tell us about the inspiration for Vancouver, a poem.
I can't really remember.
I'm thinking of Reznikov, who walks all over, and you're taking a bus all over, which is a very interesting thing.
I think it was just simply that I saw that as a topic to begin writing in the late 90s. Something to take on. I mean, I had now lived in British Columbia since 1971. I lived in Terrace, BC for 15 years. And I'd been back in Vancouver during the 90s. And we had this little group called the Dads and Tads that met at Shenanigans Pub on Robson Street. You've heard of the Dads and Tads?
No, I've heard. I've heard of Shenanigans, which is really weird. Or maybe there was a bar in Chicago with the same name.
Shenanigans is basically a Korean bar, I think. But the front part of it, really in the evening, they turned the music down, and somehow all of us Dads and Tads met there, and the reason it was called Dads and Taz is that it was a poetry group, and it pretty quickly turned out that almost everybody in the group was either in their 60s or their 20s. I mean, nobody in between. Right. So, sometime around then, I started this long beginning of the Vancouver book, which looks back to 1971. And then, of course, the big image of the W came up. And I got involved in doing this, I think, but for no more specific reason than just that it was a good idea. I had this idea of writing about Vancouver. That's about it.
You know, it's interesting. I think the first time I saw the book and picked it up, I'm like, oh, a giant W. That's the last thing an American wants to use of all the letters.
That's true. Yeah.
To have one that refers to this president,
yeah,
who we're still recovering from and will be, yes, for a long time. Can you read a little bit from the book so we get a sense of it?
Okay. Any particular part?
Well, there are many parts. I think one part that is not typical is visiting a friend in the hospital. How do you pronounce it? Brian
Looms.
Looms, all right.
What page are we on?
63, I think.
And then that ends, that part ends after about 10 lines. And do you want me to continue past that?
Read whatever you'd like. I'd really be delighted to just have this for the record.
Right. All right, I'll read that, and then I'll read two other parts of that same section. This is part 9. Visiting Brian Looms at UBC Hospital, 2 November 1999. He does the same trick with time that I do, turns away from the future back to this afternoon that he can treat like a room, float around in, keep the irreversible dimension out of sight, like behind a panel, a piece of dread equipment. And so he lies on the hospital bed, not curled up in a ball around his knowledge, but supine as the Christ, spreads his hands and says, whatever your cosmological investment, Mohammed or Motown, I want your love. And then I'll turn to the next page and read this take from the Dufferin Cafe. You can't fall asleep at the bar. And the face that turns to me, away from the bouncer's voice, under a blue cloth cap, eyes unfocused behind clear-rimmed, thick-lensed glasses, is my face, middle-aged, roundish, maybe more inoffensive than mine, and reaches for his beer. The bouncer admonishes, no, you don't get to finish your beer if you fall asleep. Are you ready to go? And the man rises and turns away, and the bouncer accompanies him through the indifferent crowd, under the rainbow-colored balloons. Write carelessly and stop focusing. I'm in the bar and James grieving, that's James Liddy, grieving for Michael Hartnett there in Milwaukee, there in Ireland. No image, just the tears, and them shed into Benedictine with some kind of monk, he wrote. No, a Benedictine monk. The mind edges away from compassion, imagining itself compassionate. Leave it to the brain. Leave it to the big boy to feel. Even if it makes big mistakes, it's the big boy. It's the one must, and I will not say die. I'm in the bar. I'm happy, but I'm lost whenever I come to this point of embarrassment, as if to take over knowledge that not yet exists, is. Write carelessly, write at the brink, like a skateboarder I just saw on TV. Wake up. What time is it? Crash into the oblong bales of hay. Set up. A couple of sections of part 10. Write carelessly but slowly. This is page 73. Write carelessly but slowly of the place you are and never fear, of the fog at UBC at noon today, not to see through. At the ginger and chili restaurant, the server seated me at a large table to share. Two women found it difficult ordering dim sum without seeing the dumplings. ordinary joy. That phrase came from the personals in the New York Review, but seated in front of me on the 10, the Chinese woman turned to her husband, each of them dandling a red-suited little girl on her, his knees in joy. Writing just to get to tomorrow, but today on the 99B line out to UBC, transferred at Alma, the fog, the trees, gray-brown trunks, to see reproduced typescript of Ginsberg's Howl at UBC bookstore and die. And then the very last part of that section. These Canadian streets, I thought, coming back from wherever I was yesterday as if I had never been here before. Yes, this not my city, I don't want to tear away from, merely left gazing at the inescapable body and mind. Memory of that bank or coffee shop, bookstore, drop-in center they tore down to clear land for the SkyTrain station, see above, that grimy wall that had been there since before I knew it, and the transfers and gum wrappers and occasional dog shit on the old gray sidewalk.
And then you go into seniors right after that.
Seniors, yeah.
You know, it's interesting that in the first section, this notion of the big boy, the mind, you know, it's the one that makes, even if it makes big mistakes. And it's interesting because this notion of mind and this notion of Spicer and how I've kind of tracked it into, and I think Williams and Olson were after this, incorporating advances in quantum physics and the notion that mind and the non-locality of it.
Yep.
So mind is not limited to the brain. And I think that's, you may not be alluding to quantum physics, but
no.
The same kind of concept is there.
Right.
This notion that mind is not limited to the brain, but it goes out, it's much larger than that.
What page is that again?
That was 65. Leave it to the brain, leave it to the big boy to feel. Even if it makes big mistakes, it's the big boy, it's the one must.
Yeah.
And I will not say die.
Yeah, the brain is the big boy. Right.
To me, that gets back to the introduction to this interview where we're looking at an industry-generated culture. We're looking at the way things are going with the torture. And, I mean, even Obama's considered left-wing. And, you know, he's drone strikes all over the world and rendition and torture and increased military spending. I mean, this is what we have for a left-wing. It seems pretty bleak, you know. And then and I think it goes back to this notion. The same thing, you know, Spicer was talking about the practice of outside, or Blaser was talking about Spicer's practice. And in my own spiritual practice, it's, surrendering to that force that's bigger. In a way, it's a similar thing with the writing that's received. You're surrendering to something that maybe you don't understand fully, but you develop an intuition for it that you begin to be able to track. And it's obviously reading this book that you've tracked it pretty well. I mean, going through, getting privy to how your mind works, like Philip Whalen said, my poetry is a picture, a graph of my mind moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's very much that, but it's, it's just fascinating to me. Very interesting that, one of the things about Vancouver, a poem, is this notion of death, of not fitting in. I mean, it's written in autumn. You know, you start with September 22nd, I think.
Yes.
And so you're, and also the poems in After Desire are also autumn poems. I mean, this could be a trope. You're in the quote unquote autumn of your life, but I sense it's more than that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Coincidence.
I don't know. I mean, I've never thought about what season I've written in each. In particular books.